Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Grapevine Open Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. I serve as the publisher at AA Grapevine, and I'll be your host for the month of February. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You can enjoy the Grapevine Open Meetings every Wednesday at noon Eastern Time on this virtual platform. The meeting will be recorded and will be posted as an audio podcast every Friday on all podcast platforms and on YouTube. This is an open meeting. Everyone is welcome. We are glad you're all here, especially newcomers. If you are new to AA and want to learn more, we encourage you to find an AA group in your area. Talking to group members will help you to find a sponsor and help you to learn about the AA program of recovery from alcoholism. This is today's daily quote from the Grapevine, February 11th, 2026. Alcoholism is relieved of its power when honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness combine within me to change my question from why to how. Then I can get into the stream of life and out of my own way. That's from the article Listening and Learning from January 2008 in the AA Grapevine. You can sign up to receive the daily quote as a daily email at aagrapevine.org, or you will find it on the app every morning. Let's start today's meeting with a reading from the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is from There Is a Solution, starting on page 23. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of a man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritable and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth, and the truth, strange to say, is usually has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. How true this is, few realize. In a vague way, their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal. But everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer will rouse himself from his lethargy and assert his power of will. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. Again, that's from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This will be a two-speaker meeting. There will be no sharing by attendees, so please sit back, relax, and listen. I love open meetings because there's no pressure, unless you're speaking, of course. We often hear it's best to try to identify with the speakers rather than compare your story with theirs. And with that, I'd like to introduce the first speaker this week, and that's Kelly. Welcome, Kelly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. I'm Kelly. I'm an alcoholic. Feeling super grateful to be here. Appreciate you asking me. I'm just having a lot of gratitude for being sober today. And my sobriety date is November 15th, 2014. I got sober in San Francisco, and I'm just blown away. You know, I came in wanting things to stop, wanting the stuff to stop in my life. I did not want to stay sober. I didn't want to stop drinking, you know, and the limitless expansion I feel in this program is nothing I could ever have imagined for my life. So what it was like, I grew up in upstate New York. You know, alcohol was always around my family. Not everyone's an alcoholic. You know, it's like there's heavy drinkers. Every family event, it would revolve around drinking. And, you know, it was always just a few people where it would hit a limit. And you'd be like, as a kid, like, what is going on with Aunt Blank? You know, there's something different with these people than the rest. And now I know it was alcoholism. And, you know, it was like there was so much love in my family, but there was just this disease. So there was chaos. And, you know, I really like that reading because my disease does center in my mind. So I didn't really start drinking heavily until later, like early 20s, but I see it in my life as the bondage of self before then, you know. And so early on, there was chaos, some abuse, and I really wanted to get out of here, you know, out of my head. And the way I did that first was like, well, my problem is this small town in upstate New York, you know, like I was obsessed with like movie stars, and I was like, I just need to be found out, you know. It's like I need to arrive somewhere and then I will feel comfortable in my skin. And so that kept me away from drinking for a while because I was so obsessed with getting out of my small town. And, you know, and then my first addiction really was being perfect. If I'm just perfect, you know, like if teachers are proud of me, if my parents, if I don't cause any issues, then I'll just be able to succeed and get out of here, you know. But that bondage of self, I remember as a kid, there was almost like a crossing point where I was just living, you know, like as a kid, you'd just be out in your imagination and it was free. And then it became the story of Kelly. And it was like, okay, what does Kelly need? What is, you know, and it's like that, that's how I feel like the bondage of self is as an alcoholic. It's like, whatever's happening in my head is more important than anything out here. I need to make sure I, you know, self-reliance. And so, long story short, I got out of my small town and everywhere I go, there I am. And, getting out of that town didn't fix me. And, you know, through this time I would drink every once in a while, but, and I knew I would love it, but it was like, not yet. But it was like, I would get out of my head through other destructive activities, like, you know, self-harm, things like that. Same thinking, like, let me just get out of my head. And, eventually, I graduated college. I didn't get that perfect job, that perfect relationship. I was working at a bar, and it seemed like it was time. You know, it was like I get free drinks. And this was at 20, turning 21. I was working at a music venue, and it was like my 21st birthday, I got my shift drink where it was like, oh, Kelly, you get a free drink after work now that you're 21. And it was like, it was off to the races. You know, it was like, I went from 0 to 100. It was, you know, that night I blacked out. I was living in DC. I woke up in Maryland, and it was like, that was my life now. And, you know, it kind of just took priority from there. It was like, I love this feeling of getting out of myself. I don't have to be like in this pr self-constructed prison anymore. I don't really care about the consequences because it's better than nothing. You know, it was a better solution. And yeah, all of those different plans I had for my life took a backseat. And my drinking just really, it was, you know, I was able to keep my job. After college, I got a job teaching during the day, and I worked at music venues at night. And since I was 21, like the hangovers were there, but it wasn't really like huge. And the consequences were really on, you know, like the moral fiber and just the shame and all of the next day things. And though I was able to keep my job, the people closest to me saw my alcoholism, and they were scared for me. My good friends didn't understand what was happening. I would put myself in all these dangerous situations. It was really like I didn't care what happened to me. And you know, now I look back, and there was a lot of untreated trauma, all of this stuff that I was just trying to black out. And I love the part in We Agnostics that talks about what we were like, because this to me nails it. When I first read this, because I came into AA like, I don't want to stop drinking because I'm just a bad person even when I'm not drinking. And when it on page 52, it talked about all of these things that were spot on for me. We were having trouble with personal relationships. Yes. We couldn't control our emotional natures. I mean, anything could break me down. You know, it was like any circumstance, any person. And so I kept my life so small because I was scared of everything. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. Yeah, all of my money went to drinking. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. You know, that uselessness, I looked up to my grandma all growing up, and she was the most kind person. She would be of service all the time, and she wasn't one of us. And I wanted to be like her. But when I'm drinking, all of that takes a back seat. You know, it's like my alcoholism doesn't care about that stuff, you know? And so it was like I couldn't be useful to others, I couldn't be of service. I was full of fear. Fear was in the driving seat. And I couldn't seem to be of real help to other people, you know, and that nails my alcoholism. And you know, I got to the point, so that was at, you know, 21. At 22, people were suggesting I should go to AA, and someone brought me to my first meeting. I was not ready at all. In fact, I was hoping that they could see that they should just keep drinking because this was really, you know, it was someone I was dating that was trying to get sober. And I was like, no. But so I came into a meeting in Oakland and I just heard chanting. You know, I grew up Catholic and I was just like very resentful. No God, please, blah, blah, blah. And so it took more years of all of those destructive relationships, all of that drinking, until finally I was willing to listen to someone in the program. And I met this woman who was in the program 7 years, and she met me at a coffee shop. And I remember how blown away I was with how comfortable she was in her skin. You know, she wasn't trying to be anyone else. She was honest with me about her drinking. I related. And it was enough to get me to my first meeting, honestly, you know. And from there, I started working the steps with a sponsor. You know, my sponsor had 7 months, and I still use what she gave me because she was just using what her sponsor gave her. And it was like, it saved my life. And I started working the steps, and I didn't stay that time, but you know, I started to get relief. You know, my sponsor, the first thing she gave me was this little formula her sponsor gave her, which was God's part is what's happening. And by the way, I was like, no, that's not going to work. I can't use the word God. And she's like, just use reality, Kelly. So she was like, reality is what's happening, and your part is what you think should happen and should have happened. And we're going to do these steps. So you're more in the reality part and less in your little world, And that kind of made sense to me. So I was like, okay, let's keep going with this. And, we kept started working through. Step three was huge for me. Just, I had so many resentments towards God, and what my sponsor gave me was to get to know the create, or sorry, to get to know the creator, I can get to know the creation. And so what that meant to me was, instead of figuring out what God is, what my higher power is, maybe I can start noticing what's around me and some reliability in the world that's outside of my brain, and I started getting relief. And that gave me kind of the key out of my bondage of self. And step four and five were, and still are, probably the most significant part of my journey in sobriety. I still, my sponsor gave me inventories probably the first week because I was so resentful of people, places, things, institutions. And now it's become a part of my working brain, where I can't stay resentful at someone without seeing my part. And that's such a gift because I used to feel so easily broken by the world, and the inventory process allows me to have that power. Whatever's happening in out there, I have the power to make myself comfortable by seeing what is this disturbing in me? Why am I holding on to being right? What is that giving me? Oh, it's not giving me anything. Where am I being dishonest? I'm blaming. Most of the time, if this person was different, I'd be okay. Well, I'm okay right now. Okay. It's like it's all around that evil and corroding thread of fear, So it's like anytime I do an inventory and we get down to the fear, I'm not enough. My fear of being abandoned, that's been a huge thread in my life, And my sponsor said, as an adult, you can be left but not abandoned. Psh, that blew my mind. And so that is just my inventory process. But then working with sponsees, I mean, what a gift to see. I came in with all of this shame that my sponsor would listen to and say, yeah, I was there too, me too. And then I got to do that for other women in the program and see that shame just shed from their lives. And it really is, all of these defects, it's like we're just humans and this is how we connect with each other. We're all imperfect. And we just have one day at a time. We get to do a little better each day. And I just love that process. And even the worst situations, it's like, my sponsor has given me, God, thank you for this obstacle for me to practice on. It's like my loving higher power puts these obstacles in my life so I can grow. And that's it, And it's like so freeing that everyone's not out to get me because, it's like a day at a time. If I'm not working my program daily, that's when I start, I like visuals. So, like, the way I see it, if I'm really on top of my program, I'm almost like a projector screen where circumstances happen, conversations happen, and they just come and go, right? But if I'm not working my program, stuff starts to stick. Like someone will say something, and I'll be like, do, what did they mean by that? And it's like the obsession starts. And it's like, okay, I need to get back to my, I didn't make enough meetings maybe this week, or I need to reach out to another alcoholic. And that's such a gift to not have to live like that anymore, that obsessive thinking. And I just My relationship to a higher power has completely changed. I'm so grateful for that appendix in the big book, The Spiritual Experience, because I've gotten to the point where it's God of its understanding. I don't really try to understand it, but I really relate to, I've had a profound change in my reaction to life. And so I know I've had a spiritual experience. I feel that unsuspected inner resource. I can handle situations which used to baffle me. I can show up whether I want to or not. I can walk through fear, and a lot of times what works for me is reality, and the last few weeks I felt like this tension because of just like things happening in the world. One of my biggest defects is self-righteousness, and I can slip into that so easily if I'm not on top of my program. And really, it's fear. And it's like, I think if I just show people why I'm right, we can, really, it's like me playing God. Like, I see what's happening in the world, and I'm like, God, you obviously need some help. This isn't cool. And it's like, if I don't do that inventory process, I stay in that. And then I'm like my sponsor would tell me, oh, Kelly's alone in her room with her right invisible right hat on. Because if I just, I think I'll be safe if I just stay in that self-righteousness, but I'm just alone and I don't want to live like that anymore. And like that, the opposite of that is connection. And so yeah, AA, I go to AA, I share honestly, and then it's relieved from me, and I get to be part of this like beautiful community. I get to be of service, and now so this higher power, I get to trust it and just kind of take healthy risks in my life instead of worrying about the future of like what's my job, what's my relationship. I just get to be rigorously honest and kind of do a trust fall, and that's kind of, being a special worker at the office, it's like, I never thought that for myself, but it was like, I saw the opportunity and I talked with God and it was just like, it was like this intuition that I've been given by the program that this is where I'm going to be of maximum service. And so far, it feels like that's the truth, And so I love that we don't have to hold so tightly to life anymore. We can really just trust our higher power and let go. And all these amazing big things happen in life because of that. My life is no longer so small. Yeah, and I get to be a trustworthy person to friends, and I get to really show up each day imperfectly. And so I'm just, I'm so grateful for this program, and I'm just really grateful that I got asked to be here today, and that's all I need to say today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Kelly. Great to hear you today. Thank you so much. I could identify those drinking years, I didn't know it then, but I realize it now that I was just trying to black out. I was just trying to like get out of life, and it was tough times. And also with my sponsor, I gave him a lot of praise for all his wisdom and help that he gave me, and he said he was just passing on what was given to him. So I can identify with that too. So thank you very much. Okay, I just want to make a few announcements before we get to the second speaker. The seventh tradition of AA states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA members can help by contributing to your group, your local office, your area and district, and to the General Service Board. There's a great pamphlet called Self-Support, Where Money and Spirituality Mix, and you can find that on AA.org. Grapevine does not accept great direct contributions, but of course we do have expenses. The best way to support Grapevine is to subscribe to the magazine, either in print, online, or on the apps. You can subscribe to the magazine in print or online by visiting aagrapevine.org. You can subscribe to the app by searching for AA Grapevine on the App Store on your phone. You can also purchase AA Grapevine books, greeting cards, and other items at your local AA office. By doing so, you'll be supporting both Grapevine and your local office. You can also visit the Grapevine online store at aagrapevine.org. The AA Grapevine Carry the Message Project allows you to help us help others by providing magazines, subscriptions to those who are incarcerated, hospitalized, living in remote areas, or stuck at home. Visit aagrapevine.org and click on the Carry the Message to learn more. We invite you to listen to our weekly podcast, the AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour, which is available for free on all podcast platforms and at aagrapevine.org. And please follow the Grapevine on Instagram and YouTube, too. Our second speaker today, I've heard a couple times. I heard him, I think he and I used to go to meetings, the same meetings back in the early 90s. And I've heard him speak at the Southeast New York convention a few years ago. Please welcome John.
Hey, everybody. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
Chris, thank you for asking me to speak. And I didn't know you were at that thing. That's funny. Yeah. And so I live here in New York City. And, you know, I'm so glad you started with the reading from There's a Solution. I'll never forget. When I first came into AA, I was just a mess. And I was desperate to find out how to not drink. And so I heard all this crazy stuff in the rooms. And I knew you had a book because of my mom. My mom got sober in AA. So I took the book and I thought, okay, well, this may tell me. And I was flipping through trying to find out how not to drink. And I got to There is a Solution. And I'll never forget when I got to that part in that chapter where There is a Solution is in italics, I started to cry. I'll never forget that moment because I was like, oh my God, there's a solution to this. Because I knew I was an alcoholic. I didn't come into AA thinking, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I knew I was owned by liquor. I had the shakes. I was managing the shakes. I just couldn't keep going anymore. I was drinking tumblers of room temperature vodka and not wanting to be doing that. Like, but I had to. So, God, I love AA. Thank God I made it here. I don't know. I grew up I grew up in Georgia. My parents were both alcoholics. My mom, I would find her hidden bottles and pour them down the sink. My dad, I would call in to work for her. And my dad, he was a Marine and he had a bottle in the shed. And I never knew which version of him was going to come home. So I was always afraid of him. So when I had my first drink when I was 15, it was a lime green punch at a party of my brother's house in Pensacola, Florida. And I only remember 5 minutes of that party. And I woke up in their bed. They had gone off to a disco and I woke up in their bed with vomit all in the bed. And I was like, I kind of remember getting up and changing the sheets or something. I don't know what they saw when they got home, but it was alcohol poisoning for sure. And I was on the beach the next day and the seagulls were squawking and I was like, I wanted to die. So I was like this with alcohol when I was a teenager. I was like, okay, because I saw what it did to my parents and it did to me. I was like, okay, be careful with this. So, but I did do a little bit of high school drinking and my mom found AA. My parents split up. My dad left the house and my mom found AA. I had been taking her to detoxes and mental hospitals and all kinds of stuff for her alcoholism in South Georgia. And she got sober. Her sponsor, a woman named Jane, she was tough. She told me, she said, stop finding her bottles, hand her the bottle and save yourself. and she was right. I didn't understand it then, but I do now. My mom got sober. So the world changed. So I went off to college in Atlanta and hit the discos. And oh my God, it was like three for ones. And I was like drinking like a crazy person. I'd forgotten, you know, and it scared me so bad. I swore off of alcohol again in college, and I became a pot smoker. And don't worry, I'm gonna get back to the alcohol stuff. But I really do believe my alcoholism said, oh, you want to go do this pot thing? We'll wait right here. And that's exactly what happened. And I became a pothead all day, every day. I got into a rock band. I was a drummer, taught myself how to drum, and off we went in a van and went up and down the East Coast and played in all these crazy clubs, dressing in all kinds of crazy outfits in the 80s. And I was high as a kite, and then the pot started to turn on me, and I became paranoid all the time, crazy paranoid. I remember being at parties, still claiming like pot smokers are the best people. Yeah, like yeah, I don't know what. And I just couldn't even talk. I was so paranoid. So I put the pot down, and you can guess what happened. I picked up beers, and I really do believe my alcoholism said, "Oh, great, he's back. Let's just go really slow so he doesn't notice." And that's what happened. It was like three beers a night. We're then 5 beers a night, then 8 beers a night, and off I went. And so in 87, our band moved to New York City in the Meatpacking District, way before it looks like now. It was not fancy at all, but we lived in this house, and I started to work in the clubs, and all the clubs, all those giant clubs of the late 80s, early 90s in New York City. It was fun and crazy and wild. And that's another thing is showbiz and the world of the clubs and stuff was not real. It wasn't real. It was like it was escape. And you know, I spent like many years in the clubs, and I look back now, and it was like these big boxes of lights, swirling lights, and crazy circus characters and crazy music and all. And it wasn't really, it was escape. I used to think that I drank to heighten the fun, which I did, but I think it was I just didn't want to be here. It's kind of how I feel now about all that. And so I was, you know, I was drinking like a crazy person in this party house, and everybody was messed up in the party house. I was working in the clubs, and everybody I was working for and with were messed up. So there was always somebody worse than me in the room. There was never a boss saying, oh, you're going to be late again today, kind of thing. So there was no guardrails. So I just got messier and messier. And I started to get the shakes. And I couldn't tell my party friends that I had the shakes. I mean, who wants to hear that when you're having a good time? And I had like I was hiding bottles in this party house, and I was hiding like open cans of malt liquor, half cans of malt liquor behind books on bookshelves. And I didn't hide it in the toilet tank because I knew my mom used to do that. So I didn't do that. I don't know if anybody would have noticed that. But it was got really bad, and we weren't paying the rent for months and months, and we would tear the eviction notices off the door and say, can you believe this? And yeah, that's if you don't pay your rent for months and months, you have to go. They put these things on your door. And I was just, you know, it's like what club, what, you know, I would work at a club, and then the after hours club, and then the after hours club after that, and then the apartment after that. And then everybody I knew had left, and I would be like, where am I and who are these people? And it just gives me the kind of gives me, you know, gives me the creeps that I was living like that. And it was I got really sad, and I knew that alcohol, I needed it in my veins. So I was it was like maintenance drinking. And I just didn't want to be doing it anymore. And I didn't want to even get off the couch anymore and go do what I was doing. I'd lost all my creative everything, and I just was like maintaining. And so what happened? Oh yeah, there were strangers in the house too. It's like, who are you? Oh, Larry said I could stay here. Oh, where's Larry? Oh, he's in Miami. Like it was, you know, I know who's in my house today. Like it was became acceptable, you know. Anyway, it was just It was awful. It's like, it was fun and crazy, and then it was like really dark. So I knew because of my mom, I wasn't about to go to AA because she went to AA, and I just thought, oh no, that's kind of drastic. But she went to these detoxes to get rid of the shakes. So I called around some 800 numbers and asked them, and they wanted money or insurance, and I had neither at that point. And so they gave me this number of this place in the Bowery. It was called BRC. There's locations all around. That one's not there anymore, but they said they'd take me in. I went in. It's really a not a fancy at all detox place. But God bless them, they let me come in and detox me. And at the like the second day, they kicked the bed. They left me alone the first day. The second day, they kicked the bed and said, AA. And so I was like, oh no. So I went into AA to the AA room, and God bless them. These guys delivered. You guys delivered the message to me, and I don't know what stuck, but I do believe a seed was planted. I do remember because I went to some AA meetings with my mom when I was a teenager that you guys were kind, so I hooked onto that. And but anyway, I still talked my way out of that place and went back to that house and started drinking and coking again, and it was crazy. And I just went further down. We all got evicted. I ended up on a friend's couch in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and I got this little crappy job. I left the nightclubs because I was trying to not drink and I couldn't do it in the nightclubs. And so I got this crappy job, and I had a six pack of malt liquor in my backpack, and I was drinking that all day at the job and crushing the cans and trying to find them hide. Anyway, that was awful. I got fired from there, and I was back on my friend's couch drinking his liquor and pouring the water in the bottle, sneaking of his liquor and saying I'd stopped. Anyway, I had a moment on this guy's couch in October of '96, and I got off that couch. I call that my higher power. And I went into AA. Now, I don't know why that day. I think the most mysterious thing of all is that the day before I went to AA, I needed a tumbler of room temperature vodka to just do anything, to answer the phone or go to the door. The next day, I'm in AA, and you guys say, you don't have to drink today. And I was like, okay. And I didn't drink that day. And then the next day, I came back and you guys said, you don't have to drink today. And I was like, okay. And I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. And the day before the day before I came to AA, I needed it in my body. So that is wildly mysterious. I just can't even wrap my head around that, even still today. But I just came in and I was so desperate. I just did anything you guys said. I was going through the book trying to like find out how to not drink, and I remember somebody handed me a friend handed me, and he wasn't even in AA. He handed me that 24-hour a day book, the little black one. That it's not approved literature, but it was the first thing someone handed me, and I was trying to find out how to not drink, and it kept saying selfish, self-seeking, and self-centered, and I was like, what does this have to do with AA? Like, what is it? Tell me how to not drink. Anyway, thank God you guys bugged me enough about a sponsor that on like day four or five, I went up to a stranger who was given the sponsorship announcement and said, I need one of those. And he took me over to this guy named Scott. And this guy, he was a completely different from me. I just come out of the crazy club scene, and he was like this Wall Street banker. And he was so sweet. He took me to my home group now today, who I still go to this home group when I had 5 days, this big beginners meeting. It's called PAX Men's Group, and I've been going there ever since. But he took me around that day. He took me around to a diner around the corner, to a diner, and told me his story. And when he got to the point where he said he used to pace back and forth in front of this liquor store at Union Square, desperately waiting for it to open up at 8 a.m. to get liquor in him, I believed him, because I was over on 8th Avenue in front of Rawhide doing the same thing, sitting on the curb, desperately waiting for it to open up. So anyway, I love this guy. He brought me and hooked me into the meeting where I go to, and I woke up at this beginner's meeting and learned how to talk again. they taught me, these guys taught me how to, they would cut you off if you shared too long. And that taught me, like, oh, John, there's other people in the room. Like, that was like a revelation. And anyway, so I've been there ever since. I got sober there. It's a big table of like 35 guys under 6 months, and the guys with a lot of time sit on the outside and listen, and we try to help them. I'm out there on the outside now, and we try to help the new guys, and it's a magical place. It's a magical holy place to me. And and the higher power, thank God, the literature, that we agnostics absolutely worked on me. It's like, oh, so you think this? Well, perhaps think of it this way. I just think the literature is so lovely and gentle. For me, it was the underlined parts of the steps as we understood them, the italicized parts in the book, like try your own conception of God, Abby says. It's like, oh, they mean this. That's I just I that helped me stay. Because I was like, I wasn't religious at all. I just felt sorry for religious people. And now I get it. It's like it's another whole thing altogether. Now I have a God of my understanding that is always with me. I talk to him all the time. Whenever I'm full of fear, I ask him to lift my fear, please. Like, help me with my words, help me be of service today. It's just, oh my God, my whole life has changed. And the steps, Kelly talked about the steps that I totally agree. Like 4 and 5. Oh my God. I'm not the same guy as the guy before I did my fourth step. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know. And this helped me. That's magical too, to me. That fourth column, my part, I remember, what do you mean my part? And I had to trick myself and say, okay, let's say I did have a part. What would that have been? And oh my God, I had so much stuff in there I learned about myself. Like, I can't tell you how many of the items on my fourth column that I had, like, bitch to anyone who'd listen on so many. Because if you wronged me, everybody had to know. Oh my God. And the character defects, like, and Kelly mentioned this too, like the need to be right, the need to be liked, the need to be loved, the need to be superior. Like, what? Like, the need to be right. Oh my God. Like, who wants that guy around? Need to be right and make sure everybody knows. And you know what? The seven, asking God to lift it. It's like over the years, they're not all gone, but over the years, it turns the volume down on all of them, and it's so good. I just love that process. It's so good. And anytime I feel fearful or I'm heading into something, I prayed before I spoke here today. It's like I just, my boss says, oh, I come in and I got something I got to tell you. And I just, if I have a second, I'll say, God, please help me be of service to this person who's my boss, and I'm more likely to go in there and listen to what he's saying instead of try to already impress him that I already know. Like, I still have that in me, but A is just, it's so great. Sponsoring people, oh my goodness. I have a couple of sponsees and they're at different speeds, and I respect that. It's just my job to nudge them along and to try to get them through the steps. And the most important thing is to get over that line to where they're now sponsoring other guys. That's tough. And when someone doesn't want it, we throw the rope, but they have to grab it. They have to grab it. And that's heartbreaking sometimes. To work with people who their story, but they're not ready yet. And it's like, there was a time I wasn't ready yet. You couldn't have told me 2 days before I came into AA, you couldn't have told me, to go to AA. I would have been like, get out of here. It's just something that happens. And like that, I think that's a higher power thing. Just one day my soul shifted and I don't, like a tectonic plate. And I just feel so grateful that I said yes to that. Like some people say, like a window opens up and you jump, or if you don't, you may not get that window again. I don't know. I don't know. It's all so mysterious. I'm just so grateful that one day I said yes to this, and I haven't not said yes to it since. I just, I'm just, I, you know, at this beginners meeting I go to, I watch these guys, they come and they go. Some stay, some will let you help them. And I get to hear how they sound before they go out. I get to watch the joy of them changing and stay. I get to hear when they come back, if they do come back, and hear what that sounded like. And it keeps it green for me. You know, it's like I don't ever, well, I'm in a middle of the boat guy. I just stay in the middle of the boat. I don't ever want to go back to counting days again, for sure. And I don't want to go back to gulping vodka all day when I don't want to be, you know, like just to function. So I'm a satisfied customer of AA. And I, you know, I didn't come here to change my life and get all the steps give me. I came here to stop drinking tumblers of room temperature vodka, and I got all this amazingness. So anyway, Chris, I want to thank you for asking me to speak, and Kelly, it was great to hear you too. So anyway, that's it from me.
Thank you so much, John. And your gratitude is contagious, I have to say. I liked what you said. you know, it's so great that the founders knew that we would be resistant, you know, and they had all these general suggestions in italics or whatever, you know, to help us say, okay, well, maybe, you know, at least that. And I remember in the big book reading that. That line about do you believe? And I was like, I don't know. Are you even willing to believe? Yeah, I guess I'm willing to believe. And then that was the beginning of it, you know, for me. So, you talked about people who talk too long. I read a joke in the Grapevine. There's a new program for people who talk too long. It's called On and On and On. All right.
You should send that to the Grapevine, Chris.
All right, I will. I thought I read it at
Oh,
the
maybe you did.
Grapevine. Anyway, thank you all, everybody who came today, and please let your friends know about our meeting. It is an open meeting, and if there's anybody out there who can benefit from learning about AA, whether it's a student or a medical worker or a anybody, you know, any kind of, if you are on a CPC committee or on a PI committee, you can certainly let people know about this meeting. Everyone's welcome. So, I want to invite Kelly, if you would you close the meeting with your choice?
Sure. Oh man, let's have a moment of silence to enjoy what John just shared. No, a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer, the we version. God,
God,
grant me
grant us the
the grant
serenity
us the serenity to
to accept
accept
the
the
things we
things we
cannot
cannot
change,
change,
the
the
courage
courage
to
to
change
change the
the
things
things
we
we
can.
can, and the
And the
wisdom
wisdom
to
to
know the
know the
balance between the two.
difference.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you, John. Thank you,
Yeah.
Kelly.
Thank
Thank
you,
you, everyone.
Chris.
See you next week. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.